Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. This is Nan Evans, and I'm here today with Jackie Canterbury. And I want to introduce Jackie to all our listeners because Jackie is joining the Nature Now team and has already started planning her many, many programs. So it's so exciting. Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you very much, Nan.
So Jackie will have a short interview at the last half of this show, but I think it's important to sort of get to know you. I've only met you really recently. And I remember the first time we met to talk about Nature Now, your passion for birds was just, it filled the space. So I am really curious how that got started. When did you first know you were falling in love with birds?
So briefly, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to be a part of Nature Now. I feel very honored. It's an incredible program. But to answer your question, it was in graduate school, actually, so it was later in life. You know, my father and I were very close, and he used to take me out, but he used to take me out hunting, which I didn't like. And I used to chase the birds away. So that was the beginning of my love and respect for birds. But actually, I hiked in the Olympic Mountains when I was in my 20s with a woman by the name of Jane Michaels, and she was in my graduate class at graduate school. And she had a big pair of hiking boots on. And so I introduced myself, and I said I'd love to go hiking. Her husband was a Vietnam helicopter pilot that got shot down, and he couldn't hike anymore. He would take us to one end of the Olympics and pick us up 2 weeks later on the other end. For example, the Elwha was a big one, the Quinault. Mm-hmm. And when I was up high up into the mountains in a tent, I would listen to the dawn chorus and I would go, what is that? That was actually, so it was later in life mm-hmm. when I first began my passion, if you will, for birds.
And as you reflect back over that period of your life and perhaps even earlier, are there other kinds of experiences and things that you've done that really helped define who you are now?
Yes, there are. Actually, I just completed reading the book that was written by my next-door neighbor, Edwin Van Sickle, and it was called They Tried to Cut It All. And I grew up in the Olympic Peninsula, third generation in that area. And I read the book and thought, my gosh, I did not really know this was going on when I was younger. But when I left, and actually when I read the book, I was just amazed at what had occurred in terms of logging on the Olympic Peninsula. And so gradually, living in Washington, I loved, of course, but I went to Southeast Alaska, and I went actually to sell cookies on the street in Juneau. At that time, a lot of people were going to Southeast Alaska. They were adventurers, explorers, and I was one of them. Mm-hmm. And I fell in love. And I remember going into a phone booth, complete with Tatsuta's supermarket sign on the outside, and there was a bald eagle sitting on top of the pole. And I thought, this is for me. Mm-hmm. I called the United States Forest Service, and I asked if they had an opening, and they said, come on over. So I started volunteering. And that is what got me started in the process of realizing what we have lost and what I was fortunate enough to be able to see. In other words, 800-year-old trees mm-hmm. in the Tongass National Forest, wildlife, birds of plenty, and lots of adventure. So that really helped define who I am.
That's interesting, and sort of having seen some of the worst of what humans have done to our ecosystem, and then being able to experience some of the lightly touched systems.
Yes, good point, Nan. Yeah. And it brings back something that you had on one of your shows, and that was that young people aren't going to know what we have lost, because when I went up there, You know, we do have these 800-year-old trees and salmon just prolific in the streams. And I think about, you know, metaphorically, you could literally walk across their backs across the stream. Well, nobody will ever see that again here.
And, you know, I remember seeing that the first time I went to Kodiak, and I was in grad school. We were getting ready to do an oceanographic cruise, but we were sort of poking around the island, and the streams were full of salmon. You could almost walk.
Good.
And I remember one of the fellow students reaching into the stream and grabbing a salmon by the tail just so that we could look at it and then putting it back.
Yeah.
It's like, it was stunning to me that it was that rich.
Yes, and that's Southeast Alaska. I mean, today, you can still see that.
So, when we were talking earlier, you called yourself persistent.
Yes.
Now, I think that's a great thing to be, and I'm really interested in why you use that term, what it means to you, and how has it changed your life?
First of all, if you think about the word persistent, it basically means continuing throughout difficult times or challenges.
Yep.
And I've actually had several people refer to me as, my gosh, you're so persistent. And I think for some reason, most of my life, I have thought I was lucky because I had a pretty wonderful father and mother and a great childhood. And I always felt a really deep-seated moral obligation to give back.
Mm-hmm.
And I also see things not in detail, but in the larger scope of things. And so that persistence, I think, has to do with that really wanting to give back to, and particularly my choices to the earth.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to the word persistent,
yes,
do you have other words that you use that sort of describe your fascination and or your passion for birds and the earth?
Sure. I think that birds captivate me for two reasons. I think they're incredibly complex.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, but then they're also very simple on the other. And they're simply beautiful. They're mm-hmm. simply elegant. But their complexity is like nothing else. And I like complex. I tend to not like simple.
Mm-hmm.
I like to figure things out, not mechanically, but using my brain.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about the complexity of birdsong, you know, the neural mechanisms that they use basically to form their song, to hear their song, it's amazing, and their pattern of migration. So I'm going to give you an example. Today I was down on North Beach,
mm-hmm.
and we saw whimbrel. Whimbrel are migrating from South America. So they can go. Now, you know, I don't know that the birds I saw today were in South America, but they travel all the way to Alaska, to the northern aspects. And so they're remarkable. Absolutely remarkable creatures.
And listening to you talk about that, I'm going, got to get out there tomorrow in
yeah,
the morning.
You do
sometime.
In the
I'm
morning.
Got to get
yes,
out.
Yes.
Now I'm also interested in why you're interested in becoming a host on Nature Now, and what do you hope to bring to the program and to our community of listeners?
Thank you, Nan. So I think what I'd like to do is bring my experience to listeners. So I actually had a program in Ketchikan, Alaska, called For the Birds.
A radio program.
A radio program. And
For
I did it
birds.
For quite a
wow.
while. And actually, from what I've heard, some parts of it are still continuing to this day. And I did it with a wonderful woman by the name of Carolyn Miner, who lives in Juneau now instead of Ketchikan. But we just had a ball doing For the Birds. And so I have done a radio program. And then the other part is I was a college educator.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty comfortable with thinking and talking about diverse topics. And also, I just think the show is so marvelous. And what I wanted to do is bring my background in community service, in ornithology, in birds, and also in conservation to the program.
That's so exciting.
Thank you.
I am just like, wow.
Thank you.
Well, which now also makes me curious, what else are you doing in the community and in conservation?
So, you know, I've only been here for 2 years because mm-hmm. I left Washington State, went to Southeast Alaska, and then I taught college in different states. So I came back, and the first thing I did, I heard wonderful things about the Land Trust.
Mm-hmm.
So I volunteer with the Land Trust, and I'm on their conservation committee. And then also, I am going to lead a new bird walk, teaching people how to bird by ear at Quimper West. And it's going to start...
I am so thrilled about idea.
It's going to start in May. So there'll be three classes, and a person can take one class or three classes. But I thought it would be really nice to teach people how to bird by ear, because when you're in a forest, it's almost impossible to see the birds unless you lay on the ground and look up.
I am horrible at bird songs, and I am so looking forward to a class that you might teach.
Good.
That might help me be a little bit better.
We shall get you there, Nan. Okay. That will be great fun.
Everybody has their story about how they got to Port Townsend. What is it that brought you to live here?
Honestly? The political map.
Okay. I so get that.
That is what brought me. And also coming home, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it was coming home to the state of Washington, and I chose not to go to Aberdeen. I wanted to try something else. And when I came to Port Townsend, I thought, it's such a beautiful community. And it felt like I fit in, that my values, hopes and dreams really fit in with this community, with all the things that are going on and the commitment. You know, for example, you know, your question about what do? I work with the land trust, but I also have done a little bit of grant writing help with NOSC. And then there's another wonderful man, Peter Bales.
Oh, yes.
And Peter is working on saving some trees. And so I've gone to testify a couple times with him and gone to a couple meetings. So there's just so many hopeful things that are happening here. And I sensed that when I came. And so that was, that intellectual stimulation is really important to me.
Yeah, and I think that probably rings many resonant bells for many folks in Port Townsend.
Yes.
It is beautiful. It is a cultural
haven.
I have amazing gratitude for living here.
Me too. And you know, a couple of the people that I worked on the Tongass, so I kind of wanted to kind of go back to that briefly, but they're here as well. So I did have friends here. My family is, you know, they're stretched all over the place, but I do also have a niece that's in Seattle. So that's been really wonderful as well.
Nice. So in the 2 years that you've been here, I know you go birding a lot.
I do.
And I want to know if you have a couple favorite places that you don't mind sharing.
I have many favorite places, actually. You know, I love what Port Townsend has done with the Quimper. You know, that's just
the wildlife corridor.
It's just absolutely incredible to go there. But I do a lot of birding on Maristone Island, a lot. And I love Fort Flagler. I really commend the state parks for, you know, we have beautiful park systems here. I love that. I love Irondale Beach. That's a wonderful place to go birding. I like Point Wilson. That's incredible. So actually, you know, I go
heard
all
the
over.
Mountain bluebirds are at Point
they
Wilson
are.
Right now.
They are.
Yes.
Yes, they are. And the Wimbrels, again, are at North Beach, and then they've also been on East Beach. So, yeah, there's just so many beautiful places. The other place I like to go is Squim. The Dungeness Spit is fantastic. John Wayne Marina is. So there's a whole little circuit that I do, and I learned it from a book called Birding in Washington State, and it gives you all the prominent birding places to go to.
Nice.
So Squim is a stunning place. The habitat's a little different than here.
Yeah.
It's more open, and then that Dungeness Spit again is fantastic.
It's
very unique.
Do you have some favorites? First of all, how about a favorite bird?
I do have some favorites. In fact, a joke I'll tell you first is I have taught ornithology, and my students, I used to take students to Belize, actually.
Ooh.
With Jerry Bricker, Dr. Jerry Bricker from Nebraska Wesleyan University. We did it for a long time, and he was the botanist and I was the ornithologist. And we'd get in a van and go botanizing and birding, and he would go, friggin' bird, friggin' bird. And then the students would make fun of me because they'd say, every time you see a bird, it's your favorite. Dr. C, what is the deal here? So I'm self-conscious about the word favorite. But my favorite birds, plural, number one is the sandhill crane, of which there were, on eBird, there was a sighting of found on the west coast of Washington State. recently, and the second one is The Rufous Hummingbird.
Oh, yes.
And I chose the Sandhill Crane because of Dr. Paul Johnsgaard. And, you know, as you can see, we're sitting in my study, and up on the wall, there's a beautiful, I know, hand-engraved drawing of Sandhill Cranes. And he's written over 100 books. He was my mentor. So when you talk about people that have really affected my life, it was Dr. Johnsgaard. And what he did is his relationship taught me so much about birds and about cranes. So I've been watching them for a couple decades. And they're fascinating because they're large, so you can easily see them. Yeah. Their vocalizations are really loud, and they have an amazing ritual. And I'm going to show you this. This basically is the Crane Display Dictionary, Nan.
Oh.
Yeah. And so what they do is they pair bond every year because they live long lives, and they mate for life. And so what they do is they have these rituals that I find fascinating. Every time they come back to the Platte River, you can watch them. So there's head bowing, there's jumping, there's wing clapping, and then they do these vocalizations that are just, they're piercing, they're really loud. And so that is what I love about the Sandhill Cranes.
Since I'm looking at it and we're not on TV, a little pamphlet that has got like maybe 12 sides to it with many displays discussed on each page with drawings and pictures. It's fascinating.
It's fascinating. And it was done by the Haps up in Fairbanks, and they were really good friends of Dr. Johnsgaard as well. No, cranes are amazing. And, you know, they're one of the many birds that have been immortalized in terms of art, paintings.
That's certainly true.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. Yes. And the other one is the Rufous Hummingbird.
Which we probably, many of us know and love.
I love Rufous Hummingbirds. And that's because they're wild. They're just wild and beautiful.
And beautiful.
Yes.
And one of the things, the complexity of birds that's always fascinated me, and I really don't know much about it, is colors in birds.
Yes.
Sometimes they're pigments.
Yes.
And sometimes, like with the Rufous Hummingbird, it's how the light is refracted by the feather structure. And it's just like, wow.
Yes. And as we know, color is to attract a mate. So you have to be bright and beautiful to get a mate.
Another subject.
Sure.
A favorite bird book.
So let's walk out here, and I'm going to show you. We're going to go out of my study, and we're going to go into my book collection, which is right here. And how can you have a favorite? So if you want to look here, so remember, Dr. Johnsgaard wrote 100 books, so these are just some of them. So when I have a question, what I do, so here's Waterfowl of North America, Brood Parasites, Grouse, North American Birds, Trogons, The Origin and Evolution of Birds, Birds of Canada.
Oh, there's one on hummingbirds.
There's one on hummingbirds. And then if you go over here, here is all his bird book on cranes. So there's Crane Music, Crane Song, The Platte Channel and Time, Faith of Cranes, Birds of Wyoming. So which one would you pick?
I'm not going to ask you that question again.
No.
Because you've got way.
To those of you who may just be joining in, I'm Nature Now host Nan Evans, and I've been talking with Jackie Canterbury, our very newest Nature Now host. Now, we will listen to Jackie's very first interview for Nature Now. Located on the shores of the North Platte River, where she recently went to view the Sandhill Crane migration and visit with ornithologist and bird photographer Tom Mingelson.
Hello, I am your host, Jackie Canterbury. My guest is Tom Mingelson. And Tom Mingelson is an internationally known wildlife photographer. He grew up on the Platte River in central Nebraska, where he has a beautiful cabin where we're sitting right now listening to sandhill cranes. Tom, welcome to Nature Now. Why do you return to this beautiful Platte River every year?
First of all, thank you, Jackie, for having me on your program. And I grew up, as you said, on the Platte River near Grand Island. And I've been coming back here for the last, I'm 77 years old. And I've been coming here, besides growing up, for the last 50 years, just to see the incredible sandhill crane migration and waterfowl migration. It's one of the great wonders of the natural world, and I often compare it to the wildebeest migration in Kenya and Tanzania. It's spectacular, and it always revives my spirit and my emotional health, put it that way. So right now, the sun is just setting, and there are hundreds of thousands of cranes going to roost just across the river here on the shallow waters and sandbars for the night, and then they'll go out in the morning to eat the waste grain left over by the... they'll go out in the morning to feed on the waste grain left over by the combining in the fall. But you can hear the cranes maybe in the background, and right now they're gathering what we call marshalling areas. They come out of the field too close to the Platte River, marshal like, and maybe an army troops would call, the troops getting ready before they make the last rush to battle. And then in another 20 minutes or so, they'll all lift off and go to the river for the night.
Can you talk about a little bit about the habitat on the Platte River and, you know, some of the interesting points about their migration and, you know, in terms of the bottleneck that actually we're in the Platte?
The cranes have been coming here, it's estimated, from somewhere between 10 and 20 million years. They found bones of the very similar species or the same species that go back to 19 to 20 million years. They've been coming here, obviously, for a very, very long time. And they come from places, so eastern New Mexico, west Texas, the Gulf of Texas, Louisiana. And they funnel up like an hourglass from southern wintering areas to the Platte River, where they'll spend approximately a month feeding on waste grain and insects and other seeds, prairie grasses, before they go to far north, up to like 3,000, 3,500 miles to Siberia, eastern Hudson Bay in Canada, to nest. So it's a very, like a 50-mile area between Kearney and Grand Island, where they've, for centuries and millions of years, have come. And then they spread out going north, again, as far as Siberia, incredible long migration, but they come here to fatten up, gain a lot of weight so they can make the long journey that far north.
And we know that sandhill cranes have a really strong family bond, and that oftentimes you can see subadult cranes basically mimicking their parents in terms of calls, but also behaviors. Can you talk a little bit what it's like to photograph cranes?
Well, I've taken literally millions of pictures of cranes over the years, mostly with my mentor, Paul Johnsgaard, who's one of the most well-known ornithologists. He's written 105 books. He just passed away about a year and a half ago. And he taught me a lot about cranes, and we've done a book on cranes together, as well as waterfowl and Yellowstone, etc. But with Paul as my guiding light, he really taught me much about cranes. And but just growing up and watching them, you know, as a field observer, they're magical in their behavior. They dance, they meet, you know, also, can you hear them just coming up now? Okay, they're coming, they're just lifting off from their marshalling area to go to the river right now. So their sounds are ancient and their behavior is ancient, and they mate for life and they're long-lived, and they have this incredible dance on their way north, and anytime when they feel a little bit anxious, or maybe during the mating season they dance more. But they pair up here and further south, and they have their subadult chicks with them, showing them the way, you know, way south and the way north back to their nesting grounds, and then they kick the kick the young ones out and they lay eggs and continue their life. But their sound and everything is very heartwarming to me. And just watching them right now with all their incredible flight patterns and sun setting and beautiful skies. It's just very special, and I wish you could all be here.
Thank you, Tom. And I know you brought up Dr. Paul Johnsgaard, who is actually my mentor as well, and that's how Tom and I met many years ago. I would like to ask you something personal, and that is how Dr. Johnsgaard affected your career in photography.
Well, if it weren't for Paul Johnsgaard, I wouldn't be talking on this podcast right now, because he was very influential in my photography and my learning about behavior birds, especially cranes, other waterfowl. But he was a huge inspiration for me, and I miss him dearly out here, because he came every year over the last 50 years. We would meet out here and photograph ducks, geese, and cranes. But huge inspiration and incredible brain and writer, artist, teacher, somewhat of a philosopher. So I'm very fortunate to have met him, and I'm thinking of him every day when I'm out here, and every day pretty much in my life.
Thank you very much for that. And another question I have is the other species that also use this beautiful Platte River. So we know that the cranes come, but can you mention some of the other, particularly waterfowl, that come through this beautiful area, which is on, of course, the Central Flyway. Washington is on the Pacific Flyway, and so this is the Central Flyway, but it's very specific to, I know, thousands of waterfowl. Can you speak to that?
Well, Jackie, it's actually millions of waterfowl if you want to count numbers, but there are some 650,000 sandhill cranes, some 20 million ducks, geese, and about half of the 20 million are snow geese that come here, which is a really sight to behold. And the snow geese come a bit earlier and stay much fewer days than the sandhill cranes. The sandhill cranes come maybe for 30 days, and the snow geese come for maybe 2 weeks. And they all left yesterday pretty much on the south wind to their nesting grounds in the far north. But like in Washington, you have the Western Flyway, where there are a lot of snow geese too in the Central Valley, which are go to similar places in the far north.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And so I think what we'll do is we will just end with a little crane music.
There you go.